Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hadrian's Wall is one of the most famous Roman sites in Britain, this physical frontier on a far-flung corner of the Roman Empire. But it was not the only wall the Romans constructed in Britain. They built another, and this one even further north, that crossed the neck of Scotland between the Firth of Forth and the River Clyde. This was the Antonine Wall. To talk about this wall and its history, I am chatting with Andrew Tibbs. Andrew has recently written a book all about the Romans in Scotland, and no surprise, the Antonine Wall forms a key part of that history. Enjoy. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, the Antonine Wall in Roman Scotland, can we say that this wall is the northernmost physical barrier of the Roman Empire?
No, that would be very misleading. It's the northernmost limit of the empire in the Antonine period, although they do fall back to Hadrian's Wall around about the time he dies. In the first century, we've got evidence of them going up into Aberdeenshire, so just outside Inverness, there are a couple of Roman camps. There are some antiquarian accounts that indicate maybe they've gone even further than that. And later, when Septimius Severus becomes emperor, he decides he's going to try and conquer Scotland. It's a bit of a pattern with the emperors. And he goes up. Now, we don't know exactly how far he gets. We know he's in Aberdeenshire. We've got evidence of him setting up Roman camps up there. We've got an account that says he stood on the edge of Britain and marvelled at how the length and the days were completely different from back in Rome. Probably a lot colder as well. We don't know where that is. It's an account. It may be fabricated. I suspect he stood somewhere and said this. But that was also pushing the limit of the empire. And even in the Antonine period, the wall is this linear complex of a monument. Complexes and has several components. But we do know they're further north. So the Antonine Wall runs very roughly between Edinburgh and Glasgow, that sort of stretch of land. Up in Perth, at the fort there of Bertha, it's originally a first century fort. We have evidence from pottery that indicates it was reoccupied in the Antonine period. So in sort of Roman frontier studies, which is my field, the word frontier, limit of the empire, edge of the empire is a very fluid term, and that it's not, we mustn't get bogged down in this sort of linear thing. So even Hadrian's Wall is never the limit of the empire. They are occupying several forts north of Hadrian's Wall. And we even have some evidence from Egypt that the limit of that frontier, we've got soldiers that are posted 100-odd miles beyond the frontier itself. So it's not a very big line in the sand for the Romans.
So what examples of Roman conquest do we have? Well, what examples do we have of the Romans in Scotland before the creation of the Antonine Wall?
The first sort of invasion is in the Flavian period. We've got a great Roman text by a guy called Tacitus, and he writes about Agricola, who's a Roman general. He's the governor of Britain. He comes to effectively conquer the north. That's what he does. we have to be careful because it is a text. The archaeological evidence sometimes doesn't lend itself to that. And indeed, beyond this book, we've only got two inscriptions that mention Agricola. And those are both from St. Albans in Chester. But he comes north. He builds a series of Roman camps and builds Roman forts. We're told that he builds a series of fortifications between two estuaries. Scholars translate that as being the Forth and the Clyde. So there's a line of fortifications there. The archaeological evidence isn't wholly supportive of that, but it isn't wholly unsupportive of it. And so he comes, he builds all his. Roman troops appear to be withdrawn, possibly because there's activity in Germany, and they fall back to what is the northernmost limits of the empire, which is the Staingate. And that's a Roman road that runs more or less between, almost between Newcastle and Bowness on Solway, so Carlisle area. We haven't uncovered all of that, but that's the sort of limit there, those fortifications. We draw from then, Hadrian comes along, builds this big wall that a few people may have heard of. There are a few outpost forts of that, as I say. Hadrian dies, and then the next guy that comes along is Fulvius Aelius Hadrianus Antoninus Augustus Pius, so the Emperor Antonine. And he decides, probably because he's wanting a bit of military prestige, he's not got a huge military background, and he decides he's going to build a new frontier, conquer Scotland, something that the great Augustus, Agricola, not Augustus, wrong period, the great Agricola didn't manage to do. So he starts reoccupying some of the southern fortifications, southern Scotland fortifications that Agricola had. And then he decides he's going to build a wall. So we've got a bit of activity going on before Antonine comes along and starts building his wall.
So now this wall is very different to Hadrian's wall in its construction. What do we know? What has archaeology told us about how this wall was constructed?
Yeah, so like I said before, wall is a bit misleading because it's a lot more complicated than that. So on the southern side, so in the sort of Roman zone, you have a road, the military way, that's the name that we've given to it. Then you have the rampart, so that's the wall part. Then you have a slight rise, which is called the berm, and then you have a ditch. Now, that's the bit that's fundamentally sort of different from Hadrian's wall, because it has a ditch in front, but it also has the vallum behind, and the vallum is a wide... It's very difficult to describe. It's a very, very wide ditch with a flat bottom. We don't really know the purpose of it. We've not done huge analysis. The Antonine Wall doesn't have that. It just has the ditch in front. When they were building the ditch, all that content is put on the front. That's to create what's called the outer mound. That's quite a rough and fairly inconsistent feature that we found. And then within that, we have these pits, which we call Lilia. And these are sort of oval-shaped pits that would have had spikes in it, possibly covered over with leaves. So if you're the enemy, you're coming from the north, you're running ahead, you see a bit of boggy ground or what looks like some rotting leaves, put your foot in it, and you go through thorns or massive spikes, giving the Romans a bit of time to chase, throw things at you and attack. Then you go over into the ditch. The ditch has this nasty little feature. Romans are really great at incapacitating the attacking enemy. They've got this little slot in the ground at the bottom of the ditch, which we call an ankle breaker. And basically, it was so steep, you just went in and would have gone over and broken your ankle. And then you're going up the mound while you've got Romans that are towering 5, 6, 7 metres above you, throwing things down on you. So that's what the Antonine Wall is. The rampart bit, the wall itself, it differs from most of Hadrian's Wall, because Hadrian's Wall is built out of stone. It's very impressive. May have had lime mortar on the front, would have looked very intimidating to anybody approaching it. The Antonine Wall is built of turf, so it's a very different construction. It's on a stone foundation. We know this, we've excavated this. You can still see bits of the stone foundation. In certain places, they have little culverts, drainage ditches built through them so the water can flow through. and then it's turf slabs. And they're just layered on top of each other. And it would have been up probably to about a height. Well, the stone base itself is about 4.3 metres wide. So it gives you an idea this is quite a big structure. And then the height would have probably been around 3 metres. Now, of course, none of it survives for anything beyond about 1.8 metres in places today. But the archaeologists that looked at all this estimate around 3 metres. Now, if you're also putting a walkway on top, we have no evidence for that. And if you ask the archaeologists that deal with Hadrian's Wall, was there a walkway on top? You get into hours and hours of debate on this because there's not evidence. But then if you're looking down on the enemy and you've got all these defensive features, you must have been able to attack them somehow. Anyway, if there was a walkway, it would have taken the height up to probably around 5 metres. So bearing in mind you've got a ditch and in places that's 12 metres wide, some places it drops down to 9 or 6, but you've got a depth of about 3.5 to 4 meters in that. So if you're down there, you're about 2 meters high, you're looking up at, what's that, 5, 6, 7, 8 meters above you, plus a Roman that would have been probably slightly under 2 meters tall. So, you know, this is a very different beast from Hadrian's Wall. Hadrian's Wall is, I think, it's the monument where they've had a bit more time to make it look a bit more intimidating, a bit more time to dig out the stone to do that. The Antonine Wall is very different. You know, it was made of turf. It was probably thrown up a lot quicker. Perhaps stone wasn't as accessible as Hadrian's Wall, but you are talking a very different wall than that.
But still, these sound like absolutely formidable defences for anyone trying to attack the wall to get past. Well, do you think these defences, are they unanimous throughout along the whole stretch of the wall? Would they have been similar all the way along from west to east?
Generally speaking, yes. From what we know, now, it's a turf wall, it's eroded, it's been built on. You're talking about the industrial heartland of Scotland. It's where the Industrial Revolution kicks off in Scotland and certain parts of the wall. And a lot of it's destroyed because of this. But from the pockets of excavation we've done, it generally seems to be similar. Now, this outer mound seems to vary in places. We have these Lilia pits. Now, we've got great examples from a place called Rough Castle. It's more or less the centre of the wall. And we've got one or two other examples that have recently come to light on Hadrian, on the Antonine Wall. And we've also got some examples from Hadrian's Wall down near Segedunum, which is at the eastern end of Hadrian's Wall. We've come across this. Now, as I say, a lot of the wall has been developed and that gives us very limited insights into what's lying underneath all the modern development. Perhaps things like the Lilia exist more consistently. We've just not looked for them. We've just not found them. Quite often, excavations of the wall haven't gone that far in front of the wall. It's just been little snapshots. The military way as well, that's another curious feature. You would expect that to run the length of the wall, but again, we have pockets of it existing and other pockets of the road not existing. So there was a guy, Daryl Roll from Durham University. He was looking for bits of the wall at Kinneil, which is in the eastern end on the Forth, and he did geophysical survey and couldn't find any traces of what he thought the road was. But again, you're talking there about a medieval tower house that's developed, had formal gardens. It could be that all this has been eroded. Sections of the road, the military way, they're not what you'd traditionally view a Roman road. They're not quite cobbled and metalled and very formal and very nice looking that we kind of see around the place. It's slightly rougher than that. So it could be a case of mistaken identity, or as I say, it's been eroded, or we just haven't found it yet. A lot of excavations don't go that far back when they're digging bits of the wall. They're not necessarily looking for the whole complex.
I mean, you mentioned the military road just then. So let's talk about, let's dive into the logistics of the wall and how it was created. Do we know anything about how the Romans would have maintained communications with forts along the length of the wall? And also, I guess, with communications with the legions stationed further south?
Yeah, I mean, you've got the traditional sort of Roman post where they would have sent messages back and forth on horseback, and presumably that's part of the function of the military way. There's also some signalling. Now, there's been a lot of extensive work by David Woolliscroft on different frontiers, and he's looked at the Antonine Wall. One of the problems with doing that sort of modelling on a site, the wall, the monument, is that it's, as I say, all this urban development. So it's not quite so easy to do signalling modelling because you don't necessarily know the topography and what other Roman sites, towers, would have featured as part of that. What we do know about the Antonine Wall, and again, similar to Hadrian's Wall, is that there are outer fortifications that aren't attached to the wall, and there were 17 forts located along the line of the wall. There's probably one or two more that are missing. But beyond the wall, we've got a number of forts as well. So in the east, we've got Caradon. It's a small fort site. We've known about it since, I think, the 17th century. It's one of the only ones that we know has a name. We found an altar stone that names what is presumably the settlement outside it. But we think that's probably part of the whole wall complex because it's showing Antonine material. Going further east into the outskirts of Edinburgh, there's Cramond, which is a Roman fort. It's got a village on it now, but pockets of excavation have indicated an Antonine date for that site. It's right on the coast. There's incredibly limited evidence of a harbour there, but again, a lot of it has been developed. In the 1690s, a man called Robert Sibbald reported that there was part of a harbour that was believed to be Roman there. So he'd found some cement mortar, lime mortar and other bits and pieces. Further east from that, on the other side of Edinburgh, is another Roman fort at a place called Inveresk. It's another river site that's on the Forth and on a river itself. Again, evidence has shown that's Antonine in date. But there's no evidence of a harbour there, although what a harbour would have looked like, whether wooden structures would survive to the modern period, given the underwater conditions, we don't quite know. So that's on the eastern side. We've got several fortifications, probably part of a supply chain heading down the coast, probably towards South Shields, somewhere like that. On the other side of Scotland, over the Glasgow end, you have the River Clyde. That's a very important river. You can get quite far inland with that. It's what made Glasgow the second city of the empire. It's such a major waterway. The Antonine Wall runs slightly to the north of that, but on the opposite side from the end of the wall. So the wall ends at a place called Old Kilpatrick. The fort there is now covered by a bus depot. Over the opposite side of the river is another Antonine fort. We've not really done much work on it. It's called White Moss, a place called Bishopton. And then you've got the land sort of curves round and heads southwards. Above the Clyde there, we've got a number of fortlets, one called Lurgmoor and another called Outerwards. They're connected by roads. They indicate an Antonine date of origin for those sites. And they probably were acting partly as signal stations so that if someone's coming up the coast can be seen quite far from there, because you're talking about being on the hills above the River Clyde, the Firth of Clyde and the Irish Sea. And you've also got a tower that would have been about 10 metres high on those sites. So you've got great signalling capacity. We've not done huge amounts of work on that. We've not done modern modelling on that. But they would have been the sort of outer limits of the Antonine Wall. And it's very similar to Hadrian's Wall on the eastern coast, because you've got all the Cumbrian forts, Hardknott and the other ones to the north that lead up to the end of Hadrian's Wall. And you've also got a series of towers that are probably used for signalling that go down the coast there. We don't really know the extent of Roman activity in the east of Scotland when you get out to the coast. There are some very old antiquarian accounts, so 300-400 years old, of Roman material coming up in a place called Largs. And it appears that this road going over the moors heads towards Largs. And then further down the coast, we've got some evidence from another place called Ardrossan. But of course, these have now got settlements on them, and very little comes out. But there was some pottery found, I think, in the 1960s from Largs found on the beach, which has only recently, in a couple of past couple of years, been dated to the Antonine period. So there's a good indication there may be something going on, but we need to do a heck of a lot more work.
Well, I look forward to seeing that work in due time. That was remarkable what you were saying, though. It sounds like a lot of the Antonine forts, well, especially near the coast, were situated along rivers.
Yeah, I mean, the whole construction of the Antonine Wall, it's on the narrowest bit of land between the east and west coasts of Scotland. So you've got in the east, so the Edinburgh side, and Bowness is where we think the wall ends. There's a modern town there, but there's indication that's probably the terminus of that end of the wall. That's on the south shore of the Forth. And the Forth comes inland and then it heads northwards and it connects with some of the first century fortifications. And then on the other coast, you've got the Clyde, which comes in, heads south by Glasgow, and that heads quite far south into Scotland. And then between those two, you've got the River Kelvin. Now, this is the industrial heartland of Scotland, as I said. We've got the Forth Clyde Canal, which runs between the Forth, more or less near Bowness. And then we have the canal going over to Old Kilpatrick, where the wall ends. So a lot of this has changed river levels. It's damaged the environment. The canal itself cuts through the Antonine Wall three or four times and that. So a lot of what we've got, we have to piece together. It's a lot different from Hadrian's Wall, which is a sort of straight line of big wall that you can't really miss. And even when it's disappeared, you roughly know where it's heading on that. But a lot of the fortifications are built more or less respecting the topography. So you've got hills to the south. The wall kind of follows that line. Then you have the valley, which is the Forth and the Clyde valleys. And then you go into the sort of hillier territory as you sort of head towards the highlands and the geological fault line and that. But they're built in the best place rather than respecting the rivers completely, although the big rivers are being used presumably for supply, troop movement, that sort of thing.
Okay, so built more as in for the best place, I guess, against people further north. And so these people who are stationed on the wall for this purpose, who were the Roman soldiers who were stationed on the Antonine Wall?
Like anywhere else in the empire, you're talking about people that came from across the empire and probably beyond in that. We haven't really found any cemeteries on the Antonine Wall, so we don't really know about the individuals too much. We've got a couple of gravestones here and there, a couple of altars. We also have things like the distance slabs, so they're quite useful. So these are markers that individual cohorts, groups of soldiers would build a section of the wall and then have a commemorative stone placed on it saying that we, whoever they are, built X number of miles or feet of Roman wall. So we have little insights like that. What we really need to do is find a cemetery and do a whole-scale excavation, because the dating you can tell from not just the objects and the materials, but also from the bones and the remains themselves tell you a whole amount about where people came from, what their diet was, whether they were eating things locally or bringing food in.
But you mentioned they're coming from all across the empire. Does that suggest that these were auxiliaries serving on this frontier rather than the hard-hitting legionaries?
We know the legionaries were constructing the wall. We've got evidence of that from the distance slabs. We've also got evidence, as I say, from people coming in and that. And it was traditional in the empire to bring people from different parts. So we know that Batesians were serving on the wall. I think there were Syrian archers. There's evidence of those from the gravestones. So I think auxiliaries and legionaries would have been serving on the wall. Just looking at that and the actual archaeological evidence, you want to find evidence of those individuals, you know, the belongings of individuals. We don't have much of that on the wall. It's not like Vindolanda, where you've gone through 12 different phases of fortification. It's waterlogged, you've got a lot of preservation. The Antonine Wall tends to be a lot of rescue archaeology in different forms and that. And we find out great things from those. But it's not always a sort of very more relaxed pace that you would have at somewhere like Vindolanda, where you target this area and you keep going for several years and we just aren't getting that on the Antonine Wall.
Namaskaram, my name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom. Kya baat hai, mom? Each home adds their special touches. Mm. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Does the archaeology that's been uncovered, does any of it suggest that the wall was ever under serious attack during its occupation?
It's a good question, and it's not something that shows up necessarily in the archaeology. You're looking for either human remains in and around the wall, maybe from a cemetery, which we haven't excavated, we haven't got any of those located. So you're looking for those sort of remains that would imply there has been some sort of attack or people have been injured. The wall being breached, because it doesn't survive in its original form, its original height anywhere, we haven't really got much evidence of anything like that. Now, it seems logical to suggest that that's a very strong possibility, but you have to bear in mind this wall was only occupied for maybe 30, 40 years, if that. It's not like Hadrian's Wall, which is more or less continuously occupied for large parts of the Roman period. For Hadrian's Wall, we've got a lot of evidence, textual evidence, that indicates the wall was breached in that. We don't really have that in the Antonine Wall. I think there are one or two accounts that imply a wall was breached, but more likely to be Hadrian's Wall, because the Antonine Wall, we think, wasn't being occupied at those times.
So I guess that goes on to the question, as you say, 40 years after its construction, it is abandoned, like a Roman generation, as it were. Do we know, once again, sorry, a very difficult question with the archaeology, but do we know why the wall really was abandoned?
No, we don't. I don't think there's anything in the textual evidence that really indicates. There's a lot of theory that again, trouble elsewhere, troops withdrawn meant a fallback. So we know the Antonine Wall's built around 142 AD, so a couple of years after Antoninus Pius comes to the throne. We know that around 158 AD, Hadrian's Wall is beginning to be refurbished. The fortification has been redone. We have some epigraphic evidence, some inscriptions that say so-and-so rebuilt this, tidied this up, that sort of thing. We believe generally that the Antonine Wall was probably abandoned around 163 to 165 AD. Slightly controversial numbers there. It's a couple of years after Antoninus Pius dies. But we also have some evidence that the wall was reoccupied again later in the period. So it's occupied about 142 to 155, but certain pockets of forts also indicate a reoccupation around 158. So at the time, Hadrian's Wall is being sort of refurbished and that. But again, we've not done huge amounts of modern excavation. A lot of our dating is limited. A lot of it is based on Samian ware and coins, which is great. but that's not necessarily given added weight from rigorous scientific testing from dendrochronology or radiocarbon dating. And that's really because, again, there's been a lot of urban-led development in that when that's caused us to excavate the sites.
I mean, it's a remarkable amount of land, just the size of it, you know, to retreat from the Antonine Wall all the way back to Hadrian's Wall. Is that like sacrificing most of modern-day Scotland, southern Scotland?
Southern Scotland, yes, it would be. And bearing in mind that there is some evidence of activity in some of the forts beyond the Antonine Wall, so Perth, the fort at Bertha up there. Again, a lot of this dating is based on pottery, and you can say the pottery was in use in these periods. Doesn't necessarily mean that there were people occupying it there. They may have been there longer. It may have been someone later, someone indigenous, coming and settling on a site that moves the pottery around. So our dating's not as precise as we would like.
Because regarding pottery and the, I guess, the civilian population, we know on Hadrian's Wall that there were a lot of civilian settlements which spring up around the forts dotted along that frontier.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that there's one on the eastern side of the Antonine Wall. I mean, how much evidence do we have for civilian settlements emerging on the Antonine Wall alongside the forts?
Again, very little. Partly because we've not done the excavation. Some sites we have surveyed, like Carradine, which is the site we were talking about. We've done quite a bit of survey there. We've not done huge amounts of excavation, but there's definite evidence of a settlement there. Further eastwards at Crammond, which isn't on the fort but dates to that period, there is a settlement there. We've done a lot of work on that. And Inveresk, which is the next site further east, which is also Antonine, we've got what looks like quite a complicated several periods of activity. I think there are two periods of Antonine activity there, and it's a settlement that expands and grows. On the wall itself, we've got very little, but that's more probably because we've not been looking for it, we've not found it, we've not accidentally dug it up and excavated, but we have quite a lot of altars that appear on the wall. And whilst the military has a lot, you do have some concentrations. Places like Croy Hill has quite an impressive collection of Roman altars. Some of those are military. Equally, some of those could apply to a civilian settlement that are living nearby. So I think there's a lot more to be discovered, but we haven't got much there. But as we see with Hadrian's Wall and other forts and other periods, there is a supply chain of goods and, you know, drinking dens and all the things that go with that, entertainment, that follow the military. It's where the money is. These soldiers have their pay, they need to spend it, and people come along and provide those services. Interestingly, though, if you go back to the first century, the Flavian period in Scotland, we have no evidence of any civilian settlements outside the fort, so no strong evidence on that. They are likely to be there. Again, we've been a bit limited in our Roman studies in Scotland, that we tend to stick to the forts and not much beyond those, which is a big weakness. It's something we're trying to address in research agendas. But we're just lacking, again, anybody outside those forts. But you come across this one site, I don't think it's been published yet, but one site I've worked on, where we've been finding bits of pottery outside. We find shapes in the geophysics. It looks like there's a settlement, but we need to excavate it before we can say this is a Roman period settlement, it's contemporary with the fort, and yeah, there's material evidence coming up that suggests there's a civilian population there.
So the Roman archaeology in Scotland today, you said it's been focused quite a bit on the forts, and of course the crisis at the moment's kind of put quite a bit on the standstill. But yeah, so what's the future direction that you and the Scottish archaeology team are looking at the moment?
Well, we're moving. We've had something called SCARF, which is the Scottish Archaeological Research Framework. It came out, I think, just over a decade, maybe 15 years ago. Brilliant document. It kind of went through all the periods of history in Scotland and looked at the strengths and weaknesses and what we need to be looking at. We are now moving, or we have been moving, I think things are probably a bit on hold at the moment, to more regional frameworks. So what's happening on a more local level, and that's a great thing that empowers local communities, reflects what people want to be aware of in the local area, and it works a lot closer with local groups and societies and museums than the original research framework did. A lot of Scottish archaeology, certainly in the Roman period, is now worked on by archaeological units because it is developer-led, developer-funded. Historic environment, Scotland do research. There's some great Roman Romanists in there. Scotland plays, we're lucky enough to have so many experts, people like Rebecca Jones and David Breeze and Lawrence Kepi. Lawrence has done a lot of the work on the wall. We're lucky to have these people at the forefront of archaeological research. We do a lot of cooperation in Scotland. We work on the frontiers. Roman frontier studies, we're trying to get more global in that. We're trying to look beyond the Scottish boundary or Hadrian's Wall or Britain. So we're trying to expand those areas. But with it being developer-led, you're very much limited to what the developers are working on that they find out. There's very limited Scottish Roman archaeological research done in Scotland. There are very, very few people doing it at universities in Scotland. I'm at Durham University. Newcastle do some stuff. Edinburgh do one or two bits. I think Glasgow do one or two bits. It's not brilliant. We need to be doing a lot more of that. But the units, the archaeological units, the developer-funded archaeology, is coming up with some great stuff at the moment. So we've found in the past 4 or 5 years in Aberdeen, they've been building a new bypass. They've discovered a new Roman camp. Because it's been discovered in the past 20 years and it's been excavated, they're doing a lot of radiocarbon dating, dates to the first century of this site. It's one of the curious Roman camps because it doesn't have any ramparts, so it doesn't appear to have any defences. It's a site called Mill Timber. The other end of the country, in Ayrshire and East Scotland, they've been building new school buildings and they found another Roman camp that dates to the first century. And as I said earlier on, we don't know much about what's happening in the east of Scotland and any of the Roman period. So those are coming out with some great stuff. But moving forward, we need to be looking at trying to fill in some of the gaps, some of our knowledge and that. So what are they doing with rivers? How are they coming into Scotland? How long are they actually staying? We need to revisit a lot of the dating for the sites. We have over 150 Roman camps in Scotland. It's the greatest concentration in anywhere in the empire. But a lot of those we haven't dated. And a lot of them are being lost because Roman camps generally aren't as well preserved because they tend to be a turf rampart in a field and they get ploughed out with time. So we need to be surveying these sites. We need to be using modern techniques. We do geophysics, certainly when we're doing developer-led stuff. But for all these other sites that aren't developer-led, that are being eroded by natural erosion and agriculture, we need to be getting out and surveying those. We need to be recording what they are. As I sort of said earlier, a lot of these were found 50, 60 years ago. They've never been revisited. Things like LIDAR, the laser scanning, we need to do a lot more of that. And it's a lot more affordable and a lot more achievable now because you can shove LIDAR equipment on a drone, shove it up and you've done it in half an hour.
Of course, what you just mentioned now, and with Scotland being this unstable frontier of the Roman Empire, the military archaeology of the Roman period sounds like it is abundant, but it's just finding it.
Yeah, I mean, as we know, we've got over 300 Roman sites in Scotland. Some of those are probable, they seem quite likely, but we need to excavate. Some of those we definitely know about, and others are a bit sketchy, but we need to rule them out. The archaeology's there. Roman camps have traditionally shown very little in the archaeological record. You've got your defences and then it would have been tents inside, so it's very difficult to show that. You know, tent posts don't tend to show up in the archaeological record because they're only occupied for a brief period. They're not leaving around a lot of material culture. It's only if they break a pot, they shove it in the ditch and then we find it later if we're targeting that area. But the archaeology is there. We just need to do a lot more of it. We excavated a site called Kintore in Aberdeenshire. It's a Roman camp. And it was on a little village and it was being subjected to a lot of development. So we excavated something like 75% of that site. It's the most thoroughly excavated Roman camp in the world. We found out so much from that. Because it's taking place in recent years, we've been able to do radiocarbon dating, so we know it's occupied in the first century. There's indications that Severus comes back and he camps there, or in the vicinity. So it's there, but it's finding the time, the money, which is the important thing. They always tell you if you go to Vindolanda, every shoe they find costs them something like £200 to conserve that. So, you know, you've got to have the money in the backup to be able to excavate these big things, which is why developer-led funding is the way we're going in Scotland. But research excavation, we need to be targeting sites. We need to revisit, as I say, all these 150-odd Roman camps and get them surveyed. Then we need to think about targeted excavation. Antonine Wall, we're quite lucky because it was visited by antiquarians, so we've got a lot of old 200-300 old accounts of what it looked like. You don't tend to get that in many other parts of Scotland.
You mentioned his name just there, Severus, and it would be amiss of me not to mention him or us to talk about him, even albeit briefly, with the Antonine Wall. Now, because the Antonine Wall, we said it's abandoned near the end of the second century, but that is definitely not the end of Roman Scotland, is it?
No, you've got Antonine Wall abandoned, Hadrian's Wall reoccupied. It probably still has a footprint in southern Scotland. And then you get Septimius Severus, who comes over, he's emperor around 180-something, I think. I can't quite remember. But around 208, he comes over to Britain and decides, I've got these two sons, they're going to both inherit the empire. They need to do a military campaign. Let's go take Scotland. It must be easy to do because no one's ever achieved it. And he bases himself at York, which is the big Ladry fortress, with some indication that when he's in York, they do some expanding of the buildings, develop it, and then the whole army moves forward north. We have a lot of large, I think it's around 55 to 65 acre camps in Scotland, and we believe those date to that period because he's bringing such a big force. We have a camp in the borders called St. Leonard's. It used to be the biggest known Roman camp in the world. It's now the second biggest because there's a bigger one in Romania, apparently, by about half an acre or something. But they march northwards, as I say. We know he stands at the end of Britain and talks about how much difference in light there is from Rome. We can plot, we think, from the camp sizes, sometimes artefacts, we can date sites, but they're going up to Aberdeenshire at least. And then he gets, well, he's quite ill and infirm when he's campaigning. He's carried about the place on a sort of sedan chair thing, returns to York and he drops dead. I think if you go into York Minster underneath, there's a little plaque on the wall where he's believed to have dropped dead. So he drops dead, and then the sons start a civil war, and everybody leaves Scotland. And that is where you think it would end. We've got a couple of accounts that imply there may have been later campaigns. Now, we don't have anything in the archaeological record, but then no one's ever really been looking for this later material. There's been no scientific dating of these sites. But we've got, I think it's over 100 Roman camps in Scotland which are undated. So we need to, again, as I say, do more work on those camps because we might be able to match up these later incursions into Scotland. But we don't know anything other than they went to Scotland sort of thing. So we've nothing showing up in the archaeological record. But Scotland seems to have been quite an attractive place for them to keep coming and campaigning. We've got three major campaigns and other periods when they're coming in.
Yes, because isn't it possible that Constantine the Great actually campaigned in Scotland just before he was crowned emperor?
There's a couple of activities, I think, in the 3rd and 4th centuries that imply that. There's one or two other people as well that's indicated they come north. The thing we've got to remember is Scotland is a geopolitical entity that's created in the medieval period. The Roman texts sort of generally sort of say Britannia, and at that period, Britannia well, after the first century, Britannia grows, shrinks and grows and shrinks and chopped up in various different ways. So when they say they're heading north, we're never quite sure where north is. Usually it's beyond a wall, they say. We're never quite sure which wall they're talking about.
And this last question, you mentioned there the antiquarians, the records that they have of the Antonine Wall. What legacy does the Antonine Wall leave on northern Britain, what now is the central part of Scotland? And you said we have written records from a few centuries in the Middle Ages and the Age of Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, we've the Antonine Wall, like Hadrian's Wall, it continues after. It stops being a Roman monument and it becomes this sort of localised entity. And of course, in Scotland, it divides the country in half. So much so, when they come to start building the canals and the industrial period, they're following the line of the wall. So we're lucky, again, like Hadrian's Wall, we've got these antiquarians which decide they're off to go walkies along the wall and chart it. We have Robert Sibbald, who he's around 1690s, he starts charting it. We've got Horsley, who I think's the early 18th century. Alexander Gordon, he's 1720s. We've got quite a few. We've got William Roy. He goes on to found what becomes the Ordnance Survey. He's a military surveyor. He's sent into Scotland after the first Jacobite uprising. It's the second Jacobite uprising. He comes into Scotland to start building roads. And he surveys a lot of the Roman monuments. We have various letters where there are accounts taken. So it's hugely important that we've got these accounts because, as I say, the Industrial Revolution really starts. You've got George Stephenson doing testing at Kinneil, early railway testing. In the centre, you've got near Falkirk, a place called Carron. That's where the ironworks build and develop, and that's next to the wall. It may have been a Roman harbour at one point. We've got a monument called Arthur's Oon, which I won't go into, but that's situated in that location. That gets destroyed because of the Industrial Revolution, where they take the stone to build a dam. We've got all this going on, so a lot of it disappears at that time. We've also got a lot of agricultural works that happen around the times of the Napoleonic Wars. They start bringing in more drainage, becoming more efficient at farming and agriculture. It's the big agricultural revolution taking place, and a lot of that damages the monuments. They start ploughing the sites out and things like that. So it's a huge period in this part of Scotland. Going back earlier than that, we have various accounts from Bede mentions the wall. So the Venerable Bede, he's around the 5th century, I think. He's not 5th century, he's 730s in Historia Ecclesiastica. We've got other accounts coming later. We have Nennius, who is a biographer of one of the saints. He talks about different aspects of the wall. Scotland has historian John of Fordun. He comes around in the 1300s. He starts recording about the wall, does a proper history of it. So this monument features in Scotland all the time. It never really becomes a geopolitical boundary. Hadrian's Wall does. And even today, people still think it's the Scottish-English border, which is more or less rubbish. There's a few places where it comes close, near Carlisle. But people see that as a boundary. Queen Elizabeth I wants to rebuild and reoccupy Hadrian's Wall. You come into, even in the independence referendum a couple of years ago, you've got newspaper cartoons doing that as the limit of Scotland and England. So the Antonine Wall never really becomes that. And I suspect that's because it's a turf monument. And by the time you're getting into the medieval period, it's eroding. The river boundaries are more important in the medieval period than the Antonine Wall, but it still plays a huge part in life. And then, say, the antiquarians from 1690s really onwards start looking at it as this wondrous Roman monument and trying to understand who built it and things like that.
Fascinating. Andrew, the book is called?
It is Beyond the Empire, Guide to the Roman Remains of Scotland.
Fantastic. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.